Good evening. I am thrilled to be able to introduce Chris Downing to you. Christine Downing, currently a professor of mythological studies at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, was the first woman president of the American Academy of Religion, the primary professional association for religious studies scholars. Her undergraduate degree in literature is from Swarthmore College. Her PhD in religion and culture is from Drew University. From 1963 to 1974, she served as a faculty member of the religion department at Douglas College of Rutgers University. She then went on to teach for almost 20 years in the Department of Religious Studies at San Diego State University, a good part of the time as chair of that department. And during the same period, was a member of the core faculty at the San Diego campus of the California School of Professional Psychology. She joined the faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute in 1995 to teach in the new program of mythological studies, commuting to Santa Barbara from her home on Orcas Island. She has also taught at the Jung Institute in Zurich and lectures frequently to Jungian groups both here and abroad and at American and European universities. The extensive list of books she's authored include the following, but this is a short list. The Goddess, Mythological Images of the Feminine, Psyche Sisters, Reimagining the Meaning of Sisterhood, Myths and Mysteries of Same-Sex Love, Mirrors of the Self, Women's Mysteries Towards a Poetics of Gender, Gods in Our Midst, Mythological Images of the Masculine, a Woman's View, and The Long Journey Home, Revisioning the Myth of Demeter and Persephone for Our Time. This fall, Chris will be teaching a new course at Pacifica entitled Sex and Gender, Mythic and Post-Mythic Perspectives, which will include many of the themes that you'll hear about tonight. Chris says that every culture seems to have had myths and rituals through which it has sought to contain and constrain human sexuality and to define gender roles. The course will focus on Hindu and Greco-Roman traditions, but will also reference Jewish, Christian, and Indigenous American perspectives, as well as contemporary attempts to move beyond the binarisms so central to the traditional understanding of gender. In addition, Chris is preparing to return to walk the Camino del Santiago in celebration of her 80th birthday this May. I met Chris on my first day as a student in the Myth program in 2008. Her energy, her wisdom, and her warmth inspired me immediately, and they still do. I studied Greek and Roman mythology, Hebrew traditions, and the art of memoir writing with her, and was blessed to have her as a member of the committee for my dissertation. I would send Chris a 50-page chapter and get it back almost the next day. Her feedback was invaluable in helping me shape my thinking, although I was sometimes less than initially appreciative when she would provide me with a list of another dozen books that I really needed to read and include in my review. But she was always right. She disagreed with part of my premise, and the ensuing conversation, which went on by Skype and email for months after I'd successfully defended my finished dissertation, led me to write another paper that I presented last spring at the annual convention for the Association for the Study of Women in Mythology. Chris is my mentor, but more than that, she is my friend. I'm thrilled that you now get to have a little taste of the wisdom and compassion that I've been privileged to experience for the last 8 years. So ladies, gentlemen, and those not so easily defined, Chris Downing.
I'm very pleased to be here this evening. And my topic, as I'm sure you all know, is the feminine, a Jungian analysis. But I need to begin by letting you know that all along, I have had a secret subtitle for my talk. And the subtitle for the talk is The Feminine, a Jungian Analysis with a Little Help from Freud. A little wrinkle that's not going to be that much of a surprise to those of you who are familiar with any of my writing or my teaching. So before I really get into my presentation, I thought I'd give you a foretaste of the direction that I intend to explore, which actually I want to acknowledge is not quite as clear-cut as I had imagined when 6 months ago or whatever I had agreed to come here. Because as it turns out, preparing the lecture has helped both clarify but also muddle my thinking. What I've been trying to do, of course, in preparing the lecture is to find and create order, but also to find some way of honestly staying receptive to what was only dimly emerging into consciousness, and the feelings also that this particular theme evokes. So, the first thing that I'm going to be trying to do is to clarify what I mean by the title. Not the subtitle part, but what I mean by calling this whole presentation The Feminine, a Jungian Analysis. And then I want to turn to spend some time on what I take to be the particular aspects of Jung's thinking that bring the problem of the feminine into focus for many of us. And then, to celebrate this recognition that there is a problem. To celebrate the recognition that it's a problem because of the way it leads us, I believe, I hope, to grapple with the mystery of the role that gender actually does play in our lives. But before moving really forward with that, I want also to rehearse how I've been wrestling with this aspect of Jung's thinking in different ways for the last 40 years. That's a long time. And then finally, I'm going to get to what turns out to be what I most want to say now. How taking a depth psychological approach to gender most centrally means taking the unconscious into account, which is going to mean that we're engaged with a mystery. So that's what we're going. Okay, so what I mean by a Jungian analysis. Just to reassure you, it does not mean that I'm going to analyze Jung. I'm not going to analyze Jung and why he viewed the feminine in the particular way that he does. Though that could be quite a romp. I do mean looking at how the problem of the feminine arises within the Jungian world by way of our different responses to Jung's substantive view of the feminine. And how a Jungian, and that is a depth psychological approach to the problem, doesn't so much resolve it as put it on a different plane. So that I hope that as I move forward with this, you'll see that how looking at gender in a way that seriously takes into account the way the unconscious plays into our own experience of gender really deepens our understanding of how gender really works in our world. So I'm fascinated, and I indicated this in my kind of pre-write-up for the talk. I'm fascinated by the way in which, for some of us, Jung's understanding of the feminine is just not helpful. and why for others it is. And so, you know, as I was kind of wrestling with that, it became clear to me that what I wanted to try and do was to move into looking at this in a different kind of way. I didn't want to get into a kind of argument. I didn't want to enter the argument about whether there is such a thing as the feminine. I decided rather that it would be more fruitful to explore it as an image, to look at the feminine as a way of looking at things, to ask, what does focusing on the feminine help us to see? But on the other hand, what does looking at the feminine as something that is there blind us to? About ourselves and about our relationships with others. So my initial idea was, what would come into view if we were to focus on the attachment to this idea of the feminine and the refusal? So ultimately, what I'm going to be suggesting is that we need to start with narrative. We need to start with our personal narratives. And I want to propose, actually, that ultimately a depth psychological understanding of the feminine, the masculine, of gender, may never truly be able to go beyond that, beyond our stories. But obviously that's something we can do better in the workshop tomorrow than we can do in any kind of full-on way here this evening. So for now, what I'm going to try and be moving towards this evening is to try to suggest a Jungian way of moving forward. But I want to do that by focusing not on what Jung has to say concretely about the feminine, but rather by trying to look at his way of looking. See, what I'm trying to do here is to bring into view the importance of being able to distinguish a thinker's method from their content. And I want to also suggest that this is a big deal problem that arises with respect to almost any thinker. It arises, for instance, with respect to Aristotle, or to Galen, or to Darwin. When with respect to any of those thinkers, if we focus on what they saw, we see how often they were wrong. But when we focus instead on their method, when we focus instead on their way of looking, we are helped to see anew, to see freshly ourselves. Do you get the difference? So I'm going to be focusing a lot more on Jung's way of looking than at the particular things that he had to say about the feminine. In other words, I want to do a kind of Jungian way of looking at the feminine that sees the feminine differently than Jung saw it. Okay. So maybe to give you a better sense of what I have in mind here, it's probably worthwhile for me to rehearse for you something that I very often say to my students when I start teaching a course on Freud. And the very first thing that comes out of my mouth almost always is that my understanding of Freud, I tell them, is a very Jungian one. And then, very quickly, I go on to say, it is not, however, one that replicates Jung's view of Freud, which I take to have been necessary for him, but radically limiting for us. So I go on to explain that when I talk about my Freud being a kind of Jungian Freud, that what I have in mind is simply that I came to Freud from Jung, that I came to Freud from someone who had been deeply immersed in looking in a Jungian way. And that the consequence of that is that when I read Freud, I emphasize the poetic and the metaphorical and the mythic aspects of his thinking. So it's a very Jungian Freud, although it's a very different Freud from Jung's. Okay. So what I propose to do this evening, or going to try to do this evening, is to look in a Jungian way, to look in a depth psychological way. And obviously, I think most of us would agree that what is distinctive, what is core, in the depth psychological way of looking at anything, it seems to me, is taking into account the unconscious. And taking into account, very particularly, the recognition that the unconscious is indeed the unconscious, that we can never fully grasp it, that the unconscious subverts our conscious understandings. So that's really, in a lot of ways, the whole theme that I want to put forward this evening. I also want to just submit here that Jung himself recognizes that what theories involve are ways of looking. Ways of looking which help us see some things and get in the way of our seeing others. You know, both Freud and Jung were very aware that the word theory comes from the Greek word theoria, and that the word theoria relates to a verb for seeing. It's the word theater comes from the same root. So theories are ways of looking. They're not something to validate or disprove. They're simply ways of looking that it's worth trying on. And what do I see when I try to look this way and when I try to look that way? And that, of course, leads me, when I'm teaching Freud in a school where everyone is beginning with a Jungian affiliation in their, or almost everyone, is to make clear that from my perspective, there's no need to choose between Freud and Jung. Not because I think they agree on everything, but rather because they each represent ways of looking that are worth exploring and discovering. What do we see when we look this way? What do we see when we look in this other way? And that there's no more reason to choose between them, for instance, than there is to choose between a Sophocles and a Euripides, or a Tolstoy and a Dostoevsky, or Shakespeare or Dante, you know? So let's have in mind that theories are ways of looking. Something that Jung himself was very well aware of. I was really grateful that when I was reading my students' term papers this particular winter, one of those papers included a quote from Jung that was just right. It's from his On the Nature of the Psyche, his wonderful 1947 essay, where he's engaged in trying to put forward his mature understanding of the unconscious. And fairly early on in this essay, he writes, "It is not a question of asserting anything, but of constructing a model that opens up a promising and useful field of inquiry. A model does not assert that something is so. It simply illustrates a particular mode of observation." Okay. So, let's explore. What do we see about ourselves, about others, about our relationships with others, when we posit the feminine as something that can be described? And what do we miss? What happens when we look at the feminine not as something that is, but as something we imagine? Can we step into this way of looking, imagining a human world peopled with masculine and feminine persons? And can we step aside? Can we imagine a world where people don't show up primarily as clearly feminine or clearly masculine? Can we open ourselves to both those ways of looking? Just putting the question this way will remind some of you that it is not for nothing that I'm known as the lady of both and. And in fact, I have a friend, actually my very first graduate from Pacifica, who says, "I've made a whole career out of one three-letter word, and." But anyway, before going beyond Jung's more substantive views, let's look first for a while at why it has come to be seen by many as problematic. I'm going to do this probably a little more briefly than it warrants, because I do want to mostly leave it behind and go on. But let me begin here by listing what I take to be some of Jung's assumptions. One, our gender identity is determined by our biology. Two, we all already know what we mean by the terms masculine and feminine. And in brief, what it is that we already know about these terms is that masculine refers to consciousness, to ego, to logos, to discrimination. And feminine refers to soul and eros and feelings and relatedness. And for Jung, these meanings, these particular meanings associated with the terms, are viewed as archetypal, as a priori, not cultural or stereotypical or based on our individual experience. And because he views them or presents them as archetypal, he regards them and encourages us to regard them as having kind of quasi-sacred authority. Okay. Women, again, from Jung's perspective, are naturally, in their conscious, egoic sense of self, feminine. And likewise, men are conscious, in their conscious sense of who they are masculine. And then, of course, Jung goes on to say, It's important for both women and men to get in touch with their latent, unconscious, contrasexual aspects. So it's important for men to get in touch with their feminine and for women to get in touch with their masculine, which means in turn that psychological wholeness, individuation, is best imagined as androgyny or with the image of sacred marriage. So the bringing together within ourselves, the conscious and the unconscious, the masculine, the feminine, or the feminine and the masculine. But he then balances this by saying, nevertheless, it is important that a man should live as a man and a woman as a woman. Now, one cannot help but read Jung, it's all over Jung, to recognize how clearly and consistently he values the so-called feminine, and how profoundly he deplores its devaluation and effective absence in our culture. And my own hunch is that many of us, both men and women, are initially pulled to Jung in large measure because of this valorization of the feminine. Or even if something else pulls us to Jung, this is one of the things that we early on particularly most celebrate in what Jung has to offer us. But then, my sense is that at least some of us become disappointed when we discover that Jung seems less interested in the psychology of women than in the feminine as men experience it. Invalidating an aspect of the male psyche largely devalued in our culture. And as most of you in the room probably know, for this aspect of male psychology, he used the word anima, the Latin word for soul, the way that the Latin translation of the Greek word psyche. Now, I'm actually not going to be doing very much with this aspect of the feminine. Had I planned to be focusing on this aspect of the feminine, I would have given my whole presentation a different title. I would have called it the anima, a Jungian analysis. And that's not what I propose to mostly be focusing on. But I do want to note how smoothly, in his writings, Jung elides from talking about the psychology of women to talking about the anima as though it were the same. It's kind of really fascinating to read any of these essays and kind of keep close watch and sort of suddenly realize, oh, we're not talking about women anymore. It's intriguing. This kind of assumption that somehow the two are the same. We may also discover that because Jung assumes a neat symmetry between male and assumes a neat symmetry between male and female psychology, he believes that he can deduce what is true of female psychology from what he knows of male psychology, rather than beginning with women's own experience. Thus, early on, way, way early on, he suggests that if men have an Oedipus complex, it follows that women would have an Electra complex. Okay. Later, similarly, he assumes that masculinity must play the same role in the psychology of women, as the feminine does in the psychology of men. And as he puts it, and it's a quote, if we speak of the anima in man, we must logically speak of the animus of a woman, his word for the masculine aspect of the female. And this is probably heretical. In fact, I added it with fear and trembling this morning and went to the dictionary to make sure I wasn't making it up. But I've always been intrigued by what I thought was a fact, and it is a fact, that outside the Jungian world, the word animus means animosity, ill will. Jung deduces that the animus has the same importance in the psychology of women that the anima has in the psychology of men. Even though both Emma Jung and Toni Wolff and many of his women patients said, Carl, well, they probably didn't say Carl. Well, Emma and Toni probably did say Carl, right? It's not exactly like that. Indeed, as Irena Claremont de Castillejo came to believe, the soul images of women are more likely to be female than male. Anyway, it sometimes sounds as though Jung believes that he can know women better than we can know ourselves. And then we may also become, some of us at least, somewhat disillusioned when we discover that it's not quite so symmetrical after all. Jung seems quite ambivalent about whether women should actually integrate their masculine side. For example, in his 1927 essay, Woman in Europe, he speaks more of animus-driven women than of women integrating their animus. The thinking of women in touch with their animus is invariably borrowed and collective, opinionated, not rationally arrived at. And he says, this is an extreme essay. I really want to clarify that. But in this essay, he says explicitly that it's better for women to stay identified with their conscious feminine aspect, with their eros, and leave logos to men. For then they, that is we, can help fertilize the feminine side of men. A woman should live as a woman. Becoming professional is injurious to a woman's feminine nature and to the men in her life. So when we closely examine the content, but remember, that's not going to be what I'm most interested in, and it's just setting things up. When we closely examine the content of what Jung has to say about the feminine, we discover that it seems to be quite culture-bound and indeed actually sometimes quite misogynist. Very different from our initial sense, I think. And this leaves some of us ready to just jettison the whole thing. Okay. But others want to say yes. There are lots of details here that don't feel quite right, but Jung is on to something. There's something important and real about the notion of masculine and feminine, and how it's connected to our having male and female bodies. We want to take that valorization of the feminine we thought was characteristic of him, that we attributed to him. We want to take that valorization of the feminine and make it real. We want to celebrate the feminine. We want to honor its beauty and power. Some of us, for instance, are drawn to worship the divine feminine. And we value the sense of knowing who we are. And we value the sense of cultural stability and order, that everyone knowing, that it follows from everyone knowing what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman. And anyway, it just feels right. Whereas others might rejoin, but things don't actually really divide up so neatly that way, that masculine and feminine kind of way. And anyway, it just feels wrong. My own hunch is that actually, most of us are really on both sides of this debate, especially once we stop arguing about Papa Jung and about theory and move into thinking deeply about our own experience of being a woman or a man. When I look at myself, I immediately recognize that, of course, I agree with those who say that it's important to give the feminine more value in our culture than patriarchy has given it. And of course, I agree. We want to push our culture to accept more variety, more mobility with respect to gender expression. But I've come to believe that these are not the most important issues. I think what's really tantalizing, and there's a kind of real conundrum here, is a sense that in some way there's something wrong about the very term feminine, and that we can't get around using it. Fixing it, revisioning it, expanding it won't really do. And yet, there's something real, there's something necessary, there's something inescapable about gender and about gender differences. We can't just wish that away. Jung is right. There's something archetypal going on here. Now, I've been wrestling with all this for a long time. It's actually the rehearsal of the list of some of my books that Jody included in her introduction suggests. And I want to talk about that for a bit. You know, almost 40 years ago, when I first began working on what became my book, The Goddess, Mythological Images of the Feminine, note the title, Feminine, right there, I found I wanted to explore the rich variety of ways of being female that the Greek goddesses embody, and how this can open us to the complexity of our own experience of being women. And I try to suggest how a mythic perspective can be more helpful than an archetypal one. Because one of the difficulties with an archetypal approach is that it tends very quickly to move to a more unified, almost monotheistic, abstract understanding, to speak of the goddess rather than the plurality of goddesses, to speak of the feminine rather than the rich variety of ways of being feminine. I also worked hard in that book to try and make clear how there's a shadow side to each of these beautiful ways of being feminine. And to also to suggest in a way that's real different from what Jean Bolen, for instance, is up to in her book, that it isn't that any one of us women is a Hera woman or an Aphrodite woman, but rather that the particular kinds of female energy that each of these goddesses represents are energies that, as a woman, all of them enter into my experience, more some at some points in our lives than at others. But anyway, I was really trying to explore the rich variety of what's included in the feminine. And as I was writing the Athena chapter, I discovered, and I'm one of these people, and I know Jody is too, because it was so clear when she was working on her dissertation, for whom writing is a process not of putting down what I already know, but of discovering. And as I was working on that Athena chapter, I discovered, kind of to my surprise actually, that I could no longer accept Jung's image of androgyny as a model for individuation. I had used to love that image, you know, and to kind of celebrate the way that I thought of myself as really bringing together some of this rich feminine stuff and having integrated some of the masculine and so on. And then, you know, as I was writing that chapter, I realized, shit, Chris, that's not what it's like. That actually, I was very aware that my sense of my creativity, of my courage, of my intellectual acumen were just as much me, mine, from the get-go. They weren't some alien having to be later integrated masculine part of me. They were just as much part of my female being here as is whatever capacity I have for intuition and nurturing and relatedness. And it wasn't that there weren't and aren't undeveloped, latent, denied parts of me, but that they don't fall along this division line of the masculine and the feminine. 10 years later, in the Body and Soul chapter of my Women's Mysteries, I tried to explore how female consciousness, women's self-understanding, may be shaped by our reflecting deeply on, be shaped by having a body that is like our mother's, by having a body that bleeds and ceases to bleed, by having a body that can conceive and give birth, that can nurse, that will die. And what I was trying to do here was to try and start not with articulating difference, but just trying to start with, well, what is? Not putting it in the context of masculine or feminine, but just what is it like to really focus on what is it like to be in the world having this kind, this a body that has these particular attributes and capacities? And a bit more tangentially, in Gods in Our Midst, which was actually written at the same time, I tried to explore the role played in my psyche, and I think in the psyche of many women, by the energies and attributes traditionally associated with the male Greek gods. So anyway, what I discovered as I was reflecting back on that long history, retrospectively, I can see how, despite my fairly radical questionings in those books of the conventional understandings of the feminine, I couldn't quite let go of the word. I couldn't quite let go of the word feminine. And I realized that I'd been pushed to these reconsiderations by my discomfort with what I took to be Jung's view. So Jung was pushing me there. So that's where I want to go. I want to go with that. I want to thank Jung for leading me, perhaps leading us, to a deep contemplation of gender, a depth psychological contemplation. Because gender, of course, is what I've been focusing on. Male and female are sex terms. That is, they refer to biological, anatomical, and physiological characteristics. Masculine and feminine are gender terms. That is what the biology is taken to imply, socially, culturally, psychologically. So the terms masculine and feminine imply a clear-cut distinction between the behaviors, activities, and attributes associated with men from those associated with women. Gender may also refer to an individual's personal sense of sexual identity. I'm a woman, and this is what it means. I'm a man, and this is what it means. Okay, so gender not only refers to identification with one sex, but entails the desire be directed towards the other sex. That is, gender is taken, ordinarily, to denote a unity of sex, gender, and desire. So that in most cultures, as in Jung, clear-cut gender distinctions imply and bolster heterosexism. So once we start thinking about gender, a whole lot of questions come up. How do we understand the relation between sex and gender? How do we understand feminine and masculine? How early and just how does gender identity become established? Or better, obviously, how do I understand the relation between sex and gender? How do I understand feminine and masculine? How early and how did my gender identity become established? Has my understanding been changed along the way? These are obviously questions we can better explore tomorrow in the workshop, where I do hope we can address them phenomenologically, experientially, personally, narratively, with our stories, not just theoretically. Questions like, when did I become aware of gender? What human attributes do I feel are a core part of me? Was that always true? Did I have a sense of the feminine as in some way less than, or in some ways more than? Now, obviously, I've been suggesting that to talk about gender, talk about gender means recognizing that femininity is a reciprocal term, that it has meaning only vis-a-vis masculinity. Although, because as Levi-Strauss has shown us, we humans are drawn to dualisms as a way of making sense of our world, it seems to be well nigh universal to posit masculine and feminine as complementary. So we've almost every culture has done this. Nevertheless, anthropology has made it clear that there's no universal definition of what constitutes, in what we might say a content kind of way, of what constitutes masculinity or femininity. Each culture has its own set of associations that's particular to it, but that sees those categories as the way they're defined in that culture as unalterable. So they vary enormously from culture to culture, but within the culture, they're seen as not alterable and as sort of having been there from forever and really being seen as somewhat in some way absolutely required by being consonant with the natural division between men and women. So in all traditional cultures, one's born into a gender. And everyone knows who they are, what it means to be a man or a woman. So in this sense, gender is socially constructed. Obviously, it's important to say that when we say that gender is constructed, that doesn't mean it's illusory. Within the culture, it's naturalized. It's taken for granted as true and has enormous power. Okay. There is always a sense of a package, a clear delineation of masculine, feminine complementarity. One is one's gender to the extent one is not the other gender. Now, as I was saying earlier, and I know you all know this, such well-established understandings of gender provide stability. They provide identity. They provide order and coherence. Now, of course, there were always exceptions, individuals who didn't fit the prescribed gender roles. Binary thinking can accommodate those exceptions by viewing them as anomalies or as pathologies. But perhaps we'd be better off beginning with variations as the given, as Darwin learned to do. And remember that even at the biological level, anatomy, chromosomes, and hormones don't always all cohere. The male-female binary doesn't quite hold even there. The binaries don't quite fit. The world eludes our attempts to grasp it. Now, clearly, part of the urgency this topic has for us stems from the fact that we, and our culture really, are beginning to recognize this. In our contemporary world, these terms, masculine and feminine, obviously no longer have the uncontested meaning, the uncontested authority that they had earlier, that they had even, you know, in my own lifetime. In my own earlier years. And I think in some ways we probably celebrate that. But I think that's also the case that probably all of us, sometimes at least, somewhat nostalgically look back to a world where those meanings were in place. Where gender seemed stable, where I knew or thought I knew who I was and who you were and what I could expect of you. By the way, this is kind of parenthetical, but I think it belongs here. By the way, I don't think substituting the terms yin and yang or lunar and solar help us get beyond the difficulties that we may sense are inherent in this masculine-feminine linguistic setup. I think the same problems persist as long as there's still a clear sense of a whole package of attributes that belong together and are associated with one pole of the binary, and insistently not the other. Where there's, you know, if you have a real clear sense of this is what goes with yin, and that's what goes with yang, or this is what goes with solar, and that's what goes with lunar, you found different names, but you're still in the same situation, really. And indeed, I think it's better to stay with the terms, masculine and feminine, that keep us connected to the mystery of our bodies and the role they play in our lives. Because, of course, gender does relate to our bodies, though more obliquely, less simply than Jung claimed, because Jung, as I was saying earlier, seemed to assume that our biology determines our gender identity. Okay, so once we get that gender is not just natural, not just given with our bodies, it becomes all too easy to fall into concluding that that means that it's all cultural. It's all socially constructed. For we do seem to become consciously aware of being gendered only as we enter into language, into culture. So I don't think it's at all surprising that most current discussions of gender, most current definitions of gender, seem to presuppose a social constructionist view. They emphasize that diversity of cultural definitions of the masculine and the feminine I've already noted, and so conclude that gender is indeed all cultural. Okay, now I'm getting to where I want to be going, because it's my sense that what depth psychology can contribute to this discussion is a perspective that challenges this dichotomy. This viewing of gender as either biological or cultural. And the way that depth psychology deepens this whole discussion is, of course, by bringing in the unconscious. And here is where I believe Freud can help. Freud, inspired by Darwin, in large measure moved beyond the binary understanding of gender to which Jung was still committed. He insisted that we need to start with the variations. Instead of starting with some fantasized ideal norm with respect to which anything that falls outside is deemed anomalous or pathological. As I noted earlier, once one gets past the binary, one can no longer subordinate dissonant gendered features as accidental in a still fundamentally intact gender ontology. So, it shouldn't be a surprise. For Jung, for Freud, unlike Jung, there is no core gender identity given to us at birth. Indeed, he says explicitly that these terms, masculine and feminine, are conventional, not properly psychological terms. Though, like us, or like me, he can't fully avoid using them. So he says, however, that he's going to use them in a very delimited, specified sense. He says, when I use the word masculine, what I mean very simply is active, active. And when I use the word feminine, what I mean very simply is simply receptive or passive. Which means that for Freud, whenever he uses these terms, masculine or feminine, he's implicitly using them with quote marks around them. Because this, he says, is fundamental. These terms, masculine and feminine, do not work as a way of distinguishing men from women. Properly speaking, this quote, the libido does not derive from any gender. To begin with, masculine and feminine, that is active and passive, aims are part of all of us, whether we're biologically male or female. And by speaking of all active desire as masculine, Freud wants to say that female desire is originally not just passive or receptive, it has an active aspect, which the move to quote-unquote normal, that is conventional, socially prescribed femininity, requires females to repress. This is that becoming Ophelia recognition, you know? Thus, Freud is suggesting that femininity, particularly in his culture, but it's a lot of this is still here, femininity is acquired as a renunciation of masculine traits. The cost of this was something that Freud already articulated way back at the beginning of his career in studies on hysteria, where he spoke of his patients as women of clear, critical intellect, great strength of character and will, but without adequate outlet for their ambition, passion, or imagination. And he said, the hysteric suffers from the rebellious desires she repudiates. He saw their neuroses as silenced messages from the bisexual archetype. That is, their hysterical symptoms as being an expression of their denied longings to exercise their intellectual and creative gifts. And toward that, so that was at the beginning of his life. And then towards the very end of his life, when asked, well, what can a woman get out of analysis? He answered, the capacity for undertaking an intellectual profession, a reintegration of her rejected masculinity. And the women he was most drawn to were Athenotypes like that. Anna O, Minna Bernays, his daughter, Lou Salome, the poet H.D. Anyway, for Freud then, gender identity is not a given, but it's an accomplishment. So he sees that the question about male and female differences is a question about gender, not biology. That is about what we take the biology to mean. And has a very sophisticated recognition that genitals don't determine gender. And during the impassioned discussions about gender that took place within the psychoanalytic community in the 1920s, he wrote, "I object to all of you to the extent that you do not distinguish more clearly and cleanly between what is psychic and what is biological, that you try to establish a neat parallelism between the two." So when Freud speaks of anatomy as destiny, not fate, destiny, he means that it's important to recognize the givens, important to recognize that I have this body, right? This particular body, with its particular attributes and so on. But that what we do with the possibilities and limitations is open. Okay. So, because to begin with, for the child, the world is not divided into two sexes, what fascinates Freud is when gender identity becomes a psychological reality. So for Freud, the psychology of gender difference begins only when the difference is experienced. And we begin to absorb, probably mostly unconsciously, the culturally normative views. You know, I discover that I'm a boy or a girl, and I begin picking up on what the culture thinks that means, right? And maybe this is important to me. He sees that experience, that discovery of gender difference, of gender identity, as traumatic, as tragic, as loss, as an entrance into finitude and limitation, and as issuing in retrospective nostalgia for a now inaccessible before. Not only because we long for freedom from culture's prescriptions and denigrations, but because of a vague, though powerful sense of having been cut off from a part of ourselves, from a now forever lost wholeness, from something unnameable but real. Not so much a both and as a neither nor. Begins to become clear that neither biology nor culture can wholly account for gender. That there's more to it than language can grasp. And here, of course, is where the unconscious enters in. For we do seem to have a sense, albeit an inchoate sense, of a before, of a pre-linguistic relation to our bodies. A relation that Lou Salome tells us, I love this line, is the persistent accompaniment of all our deepest experience, always present, yet still far beyond any possibility of hewing its way from the unconscious into consciousness. So once we bring in the unconscious, we have to bring in so much to our wonderings about gender. We have to bring in childhood memories, remembered memories, but also forgotten ones that are somehow still very dimly, very subtly sensed. Once we bring the unconscious into our reflections on gender. We have to open ourselves to wherever free associations might take us. We, of course, would be pulled to explore as many mythic amplifications as possible. We need to tend carefully to our dreams. I, for instance, and I imagine probably others of you here in the room as well, have had some very powerful dreams where upon awakening I realized, well, I was a man in that dream. And it was completely, it didn't seem strange, or it's only on waking that it's suddenly there as a recognition. So we have to pay attention to what our dreams communicate to, how gender enters really into the fullness of our being here. Once the unconscious really enters in, it seems to me, we have to begin to reflect deeply on our identifications with actual others, but also with literary figures. River and I were just talking just the other day about how, you know, we were readers from the get-go, and how so many of the wonderful books that we were immersed in our late elementary and high school years and so on, all figured male protagonists. And we weren't even conscious of kind of doing something weird as we entered into identifying with those figures. It wasn't anything you had to do. If you were a reader, you were just there. But that's, you know, that's part of really deeply informs who we are, to have had those experiences. We want really to look at what's going on in our relationships with others, to whom we may or may not respond in clearly gendered ways. Both Freud and Jung, for instance, have talked about how very often in transference, they were responded to as mother, not as father. We need, of course, to seek to become more conscious of the mostly unconscious messages we receive from how others respond to us. Something which obviously begins in the beginning. Our parents are responding to us as gendered in terms of whatever that means to them, right? Way before we have a sense of being gendered ourselves, but we're picking up something from that. Do you see how once we bring in the unconscious, there's so many more dimensions, so many more aspects to this? You know, and this all relates to how so much that happens between people happens as engagements that occur at the unconscious level on both sides. So as we begin to do this, begin to reflect on how bringing in the unconscious really complicates and enriches our whole sense of how gender actually enters into our lives, we quickly discover, I believe, that the unconscious subverts our conscious perspectives, subverts all binaries. In the unconscious, polarities, paradoxes, contradictions, all just coexist. Now, of course, it's the case that consciousness continues to want the coherence of binaries. But it's these binaries that the unconscious contests. It doesn't resolve. The unconscious is disruptive. It challenges meaning rather than providing it. Another thing that comes in once we recognize the role played by the unconscious, we also recognize the inescapability of ambivalence. We fear what we wish and vice versa, hate what we love, doubt what we're certain about. I've come to believe that once we bring in the unconscious, we can't help but recognize that gender is a mystery. That the more we reflect on it, the more we get stuck or confused or amazed. Gender, we come to see, is unplumbable, unfathomable, which reminds me immediately of something that Freud says about dream interpretation. He says that any dream interpretation, if really pursued, will eventually come to what he calls the navel of the dream. Eventually brings us to a place where we know there's more, but we just can't get to it. Now, Freud's initial example of this is in terms of his work with his own, in terms of his work with his own dreams, is a dream that made him aware of the mysteriousness of the feminine to him, to men, and then led him to recognize how mysterious he was to himself. And of course, central to my presentation this whole evening is that the feminine is just as mysterious to me, a woman, as it was to Freud. But I want to push this just a tiny bit further, which is that I think this metaphor of Freud's is so wonderfully apt. Because, of course, the navel is the mark on our body that signifies our primal connection to our mother and our separation from her, right? It marks our lost wholeness. It marks our entry into finitude. And similarly, I believe that just as Freud was saying, the more we pursue a dream interpretation, we eventually come to this navel. I believe that the more we pursue gender, we come to its navel. The feminine has no necessary positive content, and yet it's there. It's impossible to do without this concept, and impossible, really, to do anything with it. We could view this as dismaying, but at least part of me actually finds it exhilarating. Look where Jung has brought us. And let's face it, of course, we're going to try and language it, to find words for it. What does it mean to me now to be a woman, to have come into the world with this body, with its potentialities and limitations? So, let me end with yet another maxim from Freud. A good interpretation, he says, is not one that wins assent, but one that stirs things up, gets things moving.